top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. A lot going on today. This hour, I'll be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Alan West and Brett Baer standing by. Of course, we're following a bunch of stories, including the unfolding events happening with the Iran-U.S. War, the Strait of Hormuz, where most of the action is taking place. And who knows, we might be back at war shortly. Also, this whole thing about financing the government, we might get that done sometime this week, and we made some progress yesterday. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
That money is dried up. If I continue down this path the first week of May, what the Democrats need to do is explain to the American people why they want open borders. They need to be held accountable because they're putting homeland at risk.
That's so true. That is, of course, new Secretary of Homeland Security Mark Wayne Mullen. Is DHS about to get fully funded? It's all up to the House as the Senate looks like they passed a reconciliation so-called skinny bill. The question is, are they going to try to add more into it? And should they?
Number two.
You will see that these banking institutions tie directly the funding mechanisms in which the Southern Poverty Law Center used to fund at least eight hate groups they supposedly wanted to take out, but they were paying the very villains of our society they supposedly wanted to protect us from.
The Southern Poverty Law Center putting lives in danger as they pay off vile groups to create violence in this country while pretending to fight the violence in this country.
Number one.
They still fear there's Mossad agents everywhere. They're not sure who's in charge. No one knows whose orders to take and accept. So to negotiate at the highest levels with the United States of America has proven very complicated for them. And that makes it hard for our side, too.
Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, blockade in place as Iran's Mosquito Navy gets aggressive. The standoff with Iran continues, but we should update you. The U.S. has now pulled over two more ships who are far into the Pacific. Because if you are part of that so-called ghost fleet, the ghost fleet moving sanctioned Iranian oil, you are susceptible for boarding. And that seems to be exactly what we did. Brett Baer joins us now. Hey, Brett, it's really tough to, you got to stay up with this every minute to see if talks are going to be in place, to see what's happening with the Strait of Hormuz, what the blockade does, and what the Iranians are up to. And yesterday, they changed the game a little bit in taking two ships, one UK and one Panamanian.
Yeah, Brian, good morning. I think, you know, what we're finding out is that the Iranian leadership, as was mentioned by Secretary Pompeo, is fractured, and they're fighting each other. And those depictions, I confirmed that, you know, in Islamabad, there were more fights and yelling matches between the Iranians than there were between the Iranians and the U.S. delegation. And what we're seeing play out here is a fight for leadership on the ground. And the IRGC, with strength and military might, has been doing things outside of what the negotiators were going to agree to. So the question is, can you get back to the table in that environment, or do you have to wait and push the envelope with the blockade until they cry uncle? And I think the president is in that last framework in his mind. He believes the blockade is doing more than even the bombing has done.
And they talk about, really, if you're going to pump the oil, if you're Iran, you have nowhere to store it. You fill up the tankers, but the tankers can't go anywhere. Tankers can't get in.
We're probably a few days from that. I mean, we're not far from the point where their capacity to hold oil is tapped.
True. Here's Scott Bessent yesterday. Cut three.
I can tell you that it is my belief that when we talk about gasoline, that the crude market is currently in what is known in the energy business, a very steep backwardation, which means that the future prices are much lower than we are at present. I think the conflict will end. I think gasoline prices will come back to where they were or perhaps lower. As they did, President Trump has shown that he is good at getting energy prices down and that our energy dominance agenda has the lowered prices.
How fast will the prices of gasoline come down?
Again, that is path dependent on when the war and the conflict end.
Well, from a perspective of the Armed Services Committee, it's not likely to end soon.
Do That was Reid. And your thought about what he said. Do you get the sense that they feel as though it's not going to end soon?
I think they felt like it was coming to a conclusion with the Islamabad talks, and then the realization that the Iranians are so divided and so kind of chaotic on the ground leadership-wise is leading people to believe that it's going to go a little bit longer than they predicted or that they thought. I don't think, you know, the president puts out these timelines, and I think the last one he put out, Axios did a story that's 3 to 5 days and they're going to resume. And he quickly told Martha McCallum yesterday, no, that's not true. I think they're reticent to put a day on it, just knowing the uncertainty on the ground in Iran.
I understand. So Brett, as we see that Lindsey Graham was kind of putting on a soothsayer hat when he said, I think the blockade's going to expand globally. Yet first it was the Tiffany, now there's two other ships that we intercepted, a part of this ghost fleet, where Iran was selling sanctioned oil, and we think most of it goes to China. I mean, for us to go thousands of miles away from the blockade to track down Iranian oil, I think that says a lot.
Yeah, it says a lot. They're stepping up. They're increasing their reach. And it seems like the allies are starting, you know, baby steps to get into the secure the Strait of Hormuz game. And we'll see if that actually happens with physical ships.
And I will say this. It looks like, according to a report today, it looks like Europe's going to run out of jet fuel within the next 6 weeks. They have 6 weeks of jet fuel, or else they're just going to flat out run out. The fifth, as you know, jet fuel comes from the Strait. Go ahead.
Australia's already there. I mean, they're probably 2 weeks. They said that they have some reserve, but as far as the next batch, they are really going to have to stop flights.
Pretty crazy. So yesterday, we understand the reconciliation package got through the Senate. Now it's up to the House.
It is. It's the skinny package, and whether, you know, the House does something. I think the easiest thing would be to pass what's passed. But, you know, nothing's ever easy on Capitol Hill.
Because they want to add in more funding. They want to do something on the Voting Rights Act, whatever they're trying to push, the Fairness Act, whoever they're calling it. So here's what the problem is. The skinny bill is what's possible. And the House feels as though you have to add it in because it's necessary, because we can't do it through any other means. So the question is, can Speaker Johnson crack the whip? Because he didn't last time, and that's why it's been about 2 weeks since the Senate passed something originally to set up this reconciliation package.
Right. But, I mean, so understand the dynamics are different in the Senate and the House. Cracking the whip for Speaker Johnson means herding all the cats with a majority of essentially one, if you know that a couple of your guys are going to vote against what you're already doing. And so, you know, I think he's reading the room and seeing what's possible and what's not. I will say that Secretary Mullen's appeal, and you played a little piece of that soundbite, is urgent. And when you're talking about all the threats that we're facing and the possibility of, you know, attacks and that sort of thing, DHS funding is not something to fool around with, and that's their message. So maybe that holds the line for Republicans to at least advance the ball. They want the Save America Act. They want all of this stuff. They think reconciliation is the way that they could get it through. But remember, anything you put in the House, you got to get back through the Senate. And, there's some Republicans who have a problem.
So there's no problem for you with books coming up May 5th, The Case for America, an argument on behalf of our nation, which you can pre-order right now. Brett, you get some of the most successful people in the country to talk about what this country meant to them and their path to the American dream, right?
Yeah. I get amazing interviews, plus tapping into all the kind of stuff I hadn't used or maybe just briefly tapped into on the six books about presidents and how they sold America. You know, essentially the book is making a case in front of a jury of your peers about why America is great now and maybe the best days are ahead, why we have to look at it through that lens. And it doesn't sugarcoat it. It's not like just a rose-colored glasses about we don't have any problems. But hearing from these people talk about America is kind of refreshing ahead of the 250th. So I've got this website, thecaseforamerica.com. If you go on there, you could pre-order the book. You could read about the book. But you can also make your case for America and do a little video, 30 seconds or less. I'm going to choose the top 100 and send them all a signed book before the book comes out.
What a great idea. That is awesome. Excellent, Brett. So get it on May 5th. Get it by May 5th, but pre-order it now. Brett Baer, thanks so much.
Okay, see you, man.
All right, so Brett Baer joins us. That's great. And Lieutenant Colonel Alan West shortly. So the Save America Act, elements of it they want to put in to this bill, reconciliation bill, which is essentially a bill that you only need 50 votes, with the vice president 51. 50 votes to pass. You don't need 60 if you do it on budgeting or spending. If you add in legislation like the Save America Act, you need 60 votes. That's why people are saying, hey, blow up the filibuster. The filibuster makes you get 60 votes to stop a filibuster. So if you have the reconciliation bill and you decide to put some of the Voting Rights Act in there or the Save America Act in there, that's what the House is calling for, like Chip Roy. Now, I don't think there's anything negative about putting the Save America Act in there. And here's why. 76% of African Americans, 84% of Republicans, and 82% of Democrats all believe in voter ID. And if the president wants a win, tell us the ID we need, put it out there, and the pressure on the Democrats to pass it would be off the charts. But there's so much other stuff in it that allows them to fight it. That's the problem. But most of America understands, minorities and majorities, that to have a license and have a ID means that your vote is not canceled by someone who doesn't belong here. And who wants to make the effort to vote and know it's been nullified by someone trying to undo the country or is cheating, violating the law? 1-866-408-7669. I'll be able to take some calls when we get back. I'm going to read some of the emails that I got mostly last night and this morning. You'll listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Big guests, bold opinions, better information. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This week on the Fox True Crime Podcast, psychotherapist and author Lena Dhurhali breaks down the mind of Chris Watts and the warning signs behind one of America's most disturbing family murders.
Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
No, because these were not U.S. ships. These were not Israeli ships. These were two international vessels. And for the American media, who is sort of blowing this out of proportion to discredit the president's facts that he has completely obliterated Iran's conventional navy, these two ships were taken by speedy gunboats. Iran has gone from having the most lethal navy in the Middle East to now acting like a bunch of pirates. They don't have control over the strait. This is piracy that we are seeing on display. And the naval blockade that the United States has imposed continues to be incredibly effective. And to be clear, the blockade is on ships going to and from Iranian ports. And the point of this is the economic leverage that we maintain over Iran now.
So that was one of the best press secretaries ever. Caroline Leavitt weighing in, saying that, it's true, Iran took two ships. They weren't ours. And they interdicted these cargo ships, not military ships, these little Boston Whale-like boats that are tough to contain. They got hundreds of them and tough to find. You heard Admiral McRaven yesterday say it's like going up and down from the East Coast from Florida to New York and trying to find a Boston Whaler. And you got to do that through the air with these, gunboats, these warthogs, and blow them out of the water just by seeing them. So, but if you do that during a ceasefire, that could be problematic. But we are taking ships. And what I think is so significant is we're grabbing them out, way out of the other waters, because we're charting how Iran is getting their oil in and oil out. We're not letting anybody in. And we think we're going to break them first. At the very least, you got Egypt, Pakistan, Turkey, trying to push the Iranians to speak with one voice and get to the table. And then they like to delay. But let me ask you this question. They've delayed in the past, but how much times have they delayed? How many times have they delayed or been involved in talks after 12 days of being blown to smithereens? I mean, you're talking about 15,000 separate targets. And then you say, if you don't fight, if you don't come to the table, we're going to hit another 15,000. So there's a bit of an urgency here. And by shutting down the strait, you, for a while, you were taking tolls. Now nobody's getting in and out. Nobody's paying your tolls. So they made a big deal that they got like $3 million and they put it in the bank. But you're losing $500 million. So how does that make sense? Now, the advantage they have is they don't care about their people. So all the elite are getting paid. What I want to see, and I hope it's happened already, the Gulf states freezing all their funds. Here's Ted Cruz, cut one.
This blockade is imposing crippling economic cost, about $500 million a day. And we're also just a few days away from a deadline that is really consequential, which is that Iran had been exporting about 2 million barrels a day. They have limited storage capacity. In just a few days, they're going to hit their storage capacity. And when they do, they will have no choice but shut in their oil wells. Now, when you shut in oil wells, what happens is water seeps into the rock, and if you try to reopen them, production plummets. And so Iran is facing a permanent, massive degradation of its ability to generate revenue, to generate income, if it does not act.
So I think that's important, but how much pain can they absorb? Here we have election cycles, and we have approval ratings, and we'll look at all the polls and see what everybody thinks, and I got it. Over there, they don't care. They know everybody hates him. So they're going to use physical violence, hangings, executions to keep the population in check. And I was just looking at the Shah's son. He was over in Europe. And he can't believe the disconnect between and the anger people have towards the U.S. and not towards Iran. He says it's totally backwards. America should be giving credit for being the one country to take action against this cancer of the Middle East that spread their tentacles of evil and terror around the globe, combining with North Korea, at one point Venezuela, but no longer Russia and China. But the president says, hey, I'm in no rush to make a deal. So Lindsey Graham is the one who forecasted this whole blockade is about to go global. I think that's great. The Iranian officials have rejected the U.S. narrative that Donald Trump said he was misled by fake news on detained protesters. He says that didn't happen. Well, Donald Trump got word from somebody that all eight women who were going to be hanged because they protested lack of water, lack of freedom, limitations on education, they were going to be hanged for that. And the president says, don't do it. And they haven't. Now, I was talking to an exile who's now somebody who left in 2019, and she said, just watch. What they do is they wait for the spotlight to leave. They'll go grab them out of the house and kill them again. By that time, maybe the regime's out of power or certainly neutralized. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Lieutenant Colonel Alan West about our way forward, what we should be doing next. You know, he's an Army guy, but he can tell us what's going to happen about securing that uranium. And then we'll have welcome in Arthur Lee from Lightback, another great American success story. Do this to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're there.
Looking for the best place to shop this Mother's Day? Go with the brand that makes it easy to send something thoughtful to everyone on your list. 1-800-Flowers.com. Right now at 1-800-Flowers, order one dozen roses and get another dozen free. More flowers mean more smiles, all backed by the quality, attention to detail, and trusted delivery experience that make 1-800-Flowers my top choice to send something beautiful mom will love. Make mom's day at 1-800-Flowers.com/Spotify. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/Spotify.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
They still fear there's Mossad agents everywhere. They're not sure who's in charge. No one knows whose orders to take and accept. So to negotiate at the highest levels with the United States of America has proven very complicated for them. And that makes it hard for our side, too.
Does it, when you want to talk or you want to fight, they have this, what we've learned is the mosaic defense, 31 separate provinces, 31 separate defense plans. You know, the report was that after Saddam Hussein was taken out and the government fell apart, they said, we can't have the strongman government. That if we're ever invaded by the U.S., which you are, not invaded, but you're getting hit, well, like Iraq was, we got to make sure that killing one of us is not going to destroy the whole country. So they have 31 separate commands. What does that lead to? When those commands get together, nobody wants to give in. They all think they have the right answers. And then you got the political side. All evil. They're all under the same umbrella. But they all have different ideas of whether the war should stop and how should it stop and what should the demands be. We send three guys in. That's it. The Vice President, Witkoff, and Kushner. First time, evidently, broke down in the 21 hours. They couldn't agree on what to be mad at us for. So what do you do from here? Do you go back to fighting this war since the ceasefire has been extended, but yet there's more and more action in and around the Strait of Hormuz? Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins us now. Colonel, welcome back.
It's good to be back with you, Brian, and you're absolutely right in your assessment in that we don't know who we're talking with, and there are so many different various voices out there. The most important thing that we have to do is clear the Strait of Hormuz, and I think that when we look at that zone around the Strait of Hormuz, we need to be in control of that zone. We need to have a military operation that clears out any of these little Iranian fast boats. We need to be able to seize, you know, some of these key islands, such as Keshem Island. And we also need to clear out their mines, their deeper mines and also the surface mines.
So you think we got to go back to fighting to do that, right?
Yeah, I don't see what the recourse is, because the message has to be sent that the Strait of Hormuz is open, and it is open under the control of the United States of America, not under the control of Iran, because we don't know who's in charge in Iran. And I think, furthermore, when, as you heard the president say, you know, they're up to losing $500 million a day, that's where you start to put the pinch on them, regardless of who the commander is in whatever region. If they don't have the finances to be able to continue to sustain themselves, and especially to fund their Republican Guard Corps or the military, eventually those guns of those troops on the ground will be turned against them, because they're the ones that don't see any other way to go forward from this. And then also I think we need to separate them from their oil and gas capability and capacity, which means why don't we look at seizing Karg Island to further increase the economic pressure on them and continue to keep the sanctions on.
So this is what they say about Karg Island, that if if we send the army in, the 82nd, say take it, they will, but there'll be a target. There'll be a target for those cheap drones to come at them. So do you set up batteries around them? And you realize that. So if I told you it's your unit, take it, what would you do to defend your guys?
Well, one of the most important things is you put up what we call a critical friendly zone, which means that anything that looks like it's going to come into that area, you have the counter fire capability to take that that munition out, being it a drone or being it some other technology, ballistic missiles. And I don't think that Iran wants to go ahead and destroy that thing. Once again, that's a very important lifeline for them. But there's a new technology that's being developed down in Austin, Texas. It's a gun, an automated gun that can take down drones, and it's proven to be very successful.
Really?
So look that up. So we have those capabilities here. So again, I think right now is to secure that zone around the Strait of Hormuz. And look, again, I'll say that when I was a major at Fort Bragg, we did a computer simulation exercise. As a matter of fact, Keith Kellogg was the division commander of the 82nd at the time, and it was all about going in and doing an airfield seizure and bringing in follow-on forces in Bandar Abbas, which is right there. The Iranian city is right there at the Strait of Hormuz. So we have these contingency plans that we've been working on for quite some time, because that was 1997 when I was a participant.
So interesting, because I had Admiral McCraven on yesterday, and I can't remember if it was on air or not, because I had him on TV and radio, and I said to him at one point, how much work have you done on a possible war with Iran? And he rolled his eyes. He goes, almost from the day I put the uniform on. We've been hearing about Iran's going to be a problem. Be ready for an Iran operation. So Trump takes over and he takes action. And people say, where did this come from? So if you disagree with the war and the choice, don't pretend like this hasn't been the enemy, and that anyone in the military who pretends like this wasn't a problem is not telling the truth. Right, Colonel?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Look, I have told people I came on active duty at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, as an artillery officer on the 30th of October, 1983. What happened a week prior to me coming on active duty on the 23rd of October? The Beirut barracks bombing. 241 Marines, sailors, and a soldier lost their lives. So I came on active duty knowing that Iran, by way of Hezbollah and other proxy Islamic terrorist organizations, were a threat to us. So, yeah, I mean, we still had the Cold War going on with the Soviet Union, but here was a real and serious threat that we understood coming on active duty as young lieutenants at that time, and going back to Iraq and as a battalion commander, still was dealing with Iranian agents, and then of course being in Afghanistan, and later we know about the explosive force penetrator. So Iran has always been a thorn in our side, and they've always been at war with us. For whatever reason, we just tried to dismiss it and deny it.
So Lisa Deftari, born there and now has a with a whole bunch of exiles, formed her own news agency here, was on Fox News at Night last night. I want you to hear what she said. Cut 12.
The bottom line is this: whether there is a rift in their government or not, whether they're playing good cop, bad cop, or they're using it to buy out time, there has never been a moment where the regime has been as weak as it is right now. What does that mean? Maximum pressure on them continues. Sanctions, blockade continues. Maximum support for the people. Get them the internet. Get them the support they need. Get more people to defect so they have more weapons and more organization on their side. This is the time to step it up.
So never been as weak. That's the same thing Netanyahu said, but they're very diverse. I mean, they're very diffuse, I should say. So they're diffused all around. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly concur with Lisa in her assessment, and I think right now we need to understand that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is different from the regular army in Iran, and somehow we need to infiltrate into the regular army of Iran. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is like the old Praetorian Guard, you know, back in the days of Rome. So you've got those guys, but they're different from the Roman legions, and I think it's so important that we somehow get in there and create and develop some type of resistance within the Iranian army against the IRGC as we continue to degrade their capability and capacity and definitely hurt them economically.
So what, Virginia, they gerrymandered instead of a 6-5 state, it's now a 10-1 state. Then the judge stepped in yesterday and said unconstitutional. We're putting the whole thing back to normal to further notice. Here's House Speaker Jeffries prior to the judge stepping in. Cut 41.
Can you really flip 8 Republican seats in Florida?
Well, there are 8 Republican seats in Florida that will be put in significant jeopardy if the DeSantis dummy-mander takes place.
Because the next step is going to be Florida, gerrymandering in Florida to answer Virginia. It all started with Texas, but then people told me, no, it all started with New York. Because in New York, they tried to get rid of Nicole Malliotakis' district, and that failed. Yeah. A judge, you believe it or not, in New York, said they tried to do it twice. It hasn't worked. What's your thought about how this all is playing out and Hakeem Jeffries' childish nicknames?
Well, think about quite childish, quite immature and imbecilic. But when you think about what we did down in Texas, it really and truthfully exposed what the left, the Democrats, have been doing. I mean, you have some states in the United States of America that have zero Republican congressional representation, or you have a state like Illinois that has maybe 1 or 2, but yet you have, 40 to 42%, same thing that you see happening out in California. So I think that the left are upset because what we did in Texas, which was constitutional, it was lawful, it was legal. They now want to try to do things that are unconstitutional and really and truthfully authoritarian. To take a state like Virginia and all of a sudden you're going to go where 47 to 48% of the people in Virginia said that we are against this, but then you're only going to give them 10% congressional representation? No, this is not what the American people want. And they've gone too far and they've shown their hands. And I don't think that they'll be able to flip anything down in Florida. Florida has been trending, you know, quite red because of the work of Governor DeSantis, and they don't want to see the influx of people from these other states to come down and change it. So I think that the Democrats are very concerned because the Virginia Supreme Court, chances are they're going to side with this state judge, and even so, it will go to the United States Supreme Court. They violated their own law in doing what they did with this referendum. So they're not in a good position in Virginia.
All right, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, always great. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Take care, Brian.
You got it. When we come back, one of the great American success stories, Arthur Lee, founder of LifeVac. He'll be in studio. We're also going to talk about the economy. Right now, the market's down a little bit, 150 points, but still we're at 49,000 plus. We're close to the all-time highs. Why is it? Why is there so much resiliency built in our economy? We've done a wonderful job trying to pivot away where we were in the 70s, depending on Middle East oil, from where we are today. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's The Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by Fox News congressional correspondent Bill Malusian.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Must listen to podcasts from Fox News Audio.
You want truth, you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Do you disagree that Iran has received significant additional revenue from their sales of oil because of sanctions relief?
I couldn't disagree more.
Okay. Do you disagree that Russia has received significant additional revenue from the sanctions relief?
I couldn't disagree more.
So that is the Secretary of Treasury, talking about cracking down on Iran and also talking about the state of our economy. Look, the oil and gas is right where it was when Joe Biden took over. On average, it was $90 a barrel. Now it's about that. It's going up and down because we're in the middle of fighting a war and dealing with something that Joe Biden couldn't. Remember, when Joe Biden took office, this is what he said. The Houthis, they're not terrorists. Saudi Arabia, they're a pariah nation. So he released the terrorist status on the Houthis. What did they do? Shut down the Red Sea. And allowed, looked the other way as Iran was able to sell sanctioned oil, 90% of which went to Iran. Excuse me, went to China. And then they end up a nation that was going to get its economy together, of course, starving its own people. And they were using that money to build up their arsenal and their ballistic missiles. Next thing you know, we have an all-out war between Israel, Gaza, Hezbollah, all financed and later directly involving Iran. That's what the series of events that took place that set up our economy the way it is right now. With us right now in studio, man that overcame all that to not only create LifeVac, he has founded the company, which is doing exceedingly well. Arthur Lee, welcome back to the studio.
Well, thanks, Brian.
What is the state of the economy as you see it right now? When you walk around, you fill up your tank, you talk to people on a daily basis.
I don't see a dramatic change. I think we're all okay. Obviously, we want peace for the well-being of the world.
Right.
But he's doing the right thing, and we'll have to back him up.
How has this administration been to work with for you? Because you wanted to get FDA certification for your LifeVac device, which is anti-choking.
Well, I got to tell you, it was tough. But they've been responsive. You know, that I would say this whole administration has been responsive. They take action. They took down 127 knockoffs. It took us down too. But
knockoffs off Amazon where people, you invented it.
Yeah.
You have it. And then someone says, okay, that's a good idea. I'll do that and I'll sell it for less and I'll beat the founder.
Well, not only that, it's dangerous. You know, luckily the FDA stepped in and took them all down. Now they took us down too.
Including you.
Yeah, but that's okay because I'd rather be safe, right? We were still on our site. We were still selling. People were still able to get it. Amazon's a big part of it. Amazon's a dangerous place for knockoffs, right? But when we went through the FDA process, 2.5 years, every minutia of detail to make sure our country's safe, now we got FDA approval. We're the only anti-choking device that's approved. All the knockoffs are off Amazon, and we're back to where it should be, safe product for our country.
But the thing is, it blew me away, is that It's the Wild West on Amazon.
Yeah.
And that you know, people have said this over and over again, especially when it comes to the stock market, when it comes to if they want to go invest in our stock market with our stocks, instead of delisting China, for example, they just let them do it. They have no criteria. We don't know anything about their background. If you want to go invest as a company, you have to go through a background check, and we have our own system. And you're allowed to put products on there virtually unscreened to let the people decide what they want. Don't you think there needs to be some verification on this?
Yeah, well, I think there's simple. First of all, patents are worthless now because they just bypass the system and go on Amazon. The two key factors would have to be, one, if you're on Amazon, you have to have a bank in the United States. You pay tax that way. You can be litigated against. You exist, right? Because right now that money goes right to China. No tax, no ramifications. So that would stop a lot of it. Your patent would then regain its power, right? If you have a bank in the U.S. and you violate my patent, I could come after you, right?
Right.
If you're in China, I can't. So that would really be the key. It would get our taxes back, it would get us under control, and it would allow the patent to regain its power.
But are you paying U.S. taxes? So, for example, I'm with Arthur Lee, founder of LifeVac. But if I have a Chinese company, and I put it on Amazon, and then I go buy that product. I don't know where it's from. I want that product. But China's not paying taxes.
Well, they're trying to regain control of that, obviously. But, you know, 55% of sellers on Amazon now are Chinese. That money's going out of the country. When me and you worked at the Sunrise Mall, the company you bought from paid taxes. Now that money goes right to China. It's very difficult. They're not filling W-2s at the end of the year from China into the United States to give back. So we're losing a tremendous amount of money. But it's also dangerous. You know, they have no responsibility, particularly in the medical
field. You think you got this anti-choking device. It doesn't work. It
falls apart. They're horrible.
So, but you sell to other countries.
Yeah.
So what's it like in Ireland? In Ireland, a family sees it. I want to get that, which happens.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that? Do you deal with their taxes?
Well, we have offices in Canada. We have offices in the UK that handles Europe. We have offices in Australia that deal with the inter-country. You know, the U.S. is a little bit more suspect because of Amazon and the ability to get anything that's a knockoff, and the quality and the reference, you know, anything. If you bought anything on Amazon and you had a problem, and God forbid it was something like an anti-choking device, someone died, you're out of luck. You have no ability to go after them.
Can you sell anything on Alibaba?
We don't, but yeah, you can.
Because if they would allow American products to be sold on that?
Yeah.
Because that's China's version.
Right, but that's like knockoff Central too. I mean, that's where you get the knockoff for a reduced price and then resell it.
Wow. So if people, now that it's FDA approved on top of that, if people want to get a LifeVac right now, what do they do?
Well, they can go to Amazon again. It's safe. LifeVac.net or Amazon, you're okay. LifeVac is available. We're coming up on a 10-year anniversary of our first save, and we'll hit 6,000 saves any day.
Wow, that is awesome. And you have the Hall of Saves. You can see that online, right?
You can see it online.
All right, Arthur, congratulations on everything. He's the founder of LifeVac, back and still making money the American way. He's earning it. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. Of course, world events are driving the show often. Susan Page is going to be with us because the king is coming here. She's got a brand new book out called The Queen and Her Presidents, How the Hidden Hand That Shaped History. We know about the king. We've worked hard to get away from the king, and now we can't wait for the king to come visit. Mark Thiessen. He does not go into the No Kings rallies. He can't get in. He does not have the proper ID. Former chief speechwriter for George W. Bush, Fox News contributor, Washington Post columnist, is going to be with us shortly. And we're going to be moving forward on all this breaking news, including maybe some hope in the House of getting DHS funded. Can you imagine that? Which brings us to the big three.
Number three.
That money is dried up.
if I continue down this path the first week of May. What the Democrats need to do is explain to the American people why they want open borders. They need to be held accountable because they're putting homeland at risk.
No kidding, Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen. Is DHS about to get fully funded? It's all about the House. And the House wants to put more in there, like more funding for the war in Iran, like for the Save America Act, elements of it. Should they fatten it up and send it back or just pass it and be done with it? We'll discuss it.
Number two.
You will see that these banking institutions tie directly the funding mechanisms in which the Southern Poverty Law Center used to fund at least eight hate groups they supposedly wanted to take out, but they were paying the very villains of our society they supposedly wanted to protect us from.
FBI Director Kash Patel, the Southern Poverty Law Center putting lives in danger as they pay off vile groups to create violence in order for them to raise more money. I'm not kidding. You're not going to believe this story.
Number one.
They still fear there's Mossad agents everywhere. They're not sure who's in charge. No one knows whose orders to take and accept. So to negotiate at the highest levels with the United States of America has proven very complicated for them. And that makes it hard for our side, too.
Yeah, that is former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Blockade in place as Iran's Mosquito Navy gets aggressive. The standoff with Iran continues as our Navy gets aggressive, too. In international waters, we took out an Iranian ship and said, okay, you're not your ghost fleet. Well, we know who you are. And we're going to get aggressive outside just the Strait of Hormuz. Is that a good thing? Mark Thiessen joins us now. Mark, is that a good thing? We're expanding the strait?
It is. It's a good thing. Look, the president has been very patient with the Iranians. He's extended the deadline. They are not taking advantage of that. I would be very surprised if we didn't start kinetic operations very soon in the next few days. And he's sort of brilliantly played this because he used the ceasefire to steam ships into the Persian Gulf, which are now executing the blockade. And now what Iran gets, because they didn't come to a deal, Iran used to have just the receiving end of kinetic operations. Now they will have kinetic operations plus blockade. And then Admiral Cooper has a plan, which we've discussed on Fox and Friends. Admiral Cooper has a plan to open up the Strait of Hormuz. And so what will happen is the strait will be opened up once the kinetic operations are done to all the ships except Iranian ships. This blockade is crushing the Iranian economy. So more than 90% of Iran's two-way trade goes through the Strait of Hormuz now. Because of the war, a lot of their land routes are gone. So it's not just their exports. It's their imports. So Iran uses about 130 million liters of gasoline a day, but only produces 100. So they're 30 million short a day. So they import gasoline. And so what's going to happen is you're going to have fuel shortages soon. The 51% of Iran's oil revenues go to fund the IRGC. So all of a sudden, if they don't have oil revenues, they can't pay the Gestapo anymore. And the regime is coming, and they've only got about 2 weeks of oil storage, which they're coming up on right now in the next couple of days. What happens is what they've done is they've loaded up all the oil storage they have, all the tankers that they have, which are sitting. And what happens is at some point they've got nowhere to put the oil. And so you have to stop producing, and that destroys the oil production facility. You can't just turn off an oil well like you do like your bathtub. Right. If you stop it, it causes possibly permanent destruction. So they are in a world of hurt, and it's coming up in days, not weeks.
So what's your theory on if they know it? You know, that whole mosaic defense with 32 different provinces, 32 different headquarters, there are so many. You're talking about 50 to 60 leaders killed, military and political leaders killed. How much do they know how bad they're in? Bad shape they're in. What'd you say?
The dead ones know it.
Yes.
They're not with us anymore.
I mean, they still haven't buried the Ayatollah, by the way.
Yeah. Of course. Well, I mean, with that funeral would be a hell of a target, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I think they know they're in deep trouble. They're putting on a brave face, but they are in a world of hurt. And part of the reason why they can't come up with a unified position, it's not that there are factions within the regime. There are factions. There's like, you know, it's like talking about moderate Nazis, right? There's the hardliners, and then there's the ultra hardliners. There's no one moderate in the Iranian regime, but they've been so fractured by these leadership strikes and these kinetic strikes that they can't get their act together and come up with a, they have no system by which to come to agreement. They've got competing power centers. That are you know, rivals with each other, and the whole thing is in a mess. So I think if we started, Admiral Cooper had about 10 to 14 days left of strikes to finish out the targets. We've taken about 70%, 80% of their military capabilities that we had planned to take out, right? So Cooper started, you know, the Operation Epic Fury with a target list, and he's taken about 70 to 80% of that out. He needs about 10 to 14 days to finish the job. We're on anywhere between the 20 and 5 yard line, depending on what we need to do. We need to get it into the end zone and finish the job.
So I get the sense that the president would rather have the ceasefire extended, get the uranium out, and get some observable way they're not going to reconstitute it, get the strait open. You know, knowing that the midterms loom. How does that gel with maybe the best thing being that we go back and re-engage militarily? How does the president deal with both?
So first of all, I don't think that he's terribly concerned with the impact on the midterms. And I don't think he's concerned with starting kinetic operations if he needs to. This is the guy who started it to begin with. Was something no other president would have done. I think he's trying to see if he can get a deal because he's a deal maker, right? He describes himself as a deal junkie. And so he likes deals. But if there's no deal to be had, I don't think he's going to hesitate for a second to start the kinetic operations again. And then what you do, the best thing we could do right now is restart the kinetic operations, keep the blockade going, finish the job militarily, and then tell the Iranians at the end of the deal, we're gonna blow up Karg Island, which is where 90% of your oil goes through. And by the way, all of your stored oil is sitting in the tankers at Karg Island and in the storage facilities at Karg Island, which will permanently destroy your economy unless you give us the nuclear dust. And then he's in a much stronger position there to negotiate a deal in 2 weeks than he is today. And then if they don't do a deal, then we blow it up and we keep open the strait, and then we can either go in and take the nuclear dust because they're much weaker militarily in 2 weeks than they are now, which is a complex operation but can be done. Admiral Cooper has a plan for it. Jack Keane thinks it can be done. Or we simply draw a circle of death around it and say any Iranian who goes in this circle of death will die. And we can monitor 24/7, and we draw it around all of the nuclear sites, including the new ones that they have, and then we just enforce it, and they can't get anywhere near it. And then what we do is we do what Ronald Reagan did during the Cold War, which is provide arms and training to Iranians to overthrow their regime. We overthrew the Soviet Union by arming and training freedom fighters around the world. This is something the CIA has done for decades. I think we had something to do with the coup in the 1950s that overthrew the Iranian government. So why can't we overthrow another Iranian government? And then just end this thing.
So I want to also talk about the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is pretty amazing. You have a group that exists to fight hate, and it turns out they were hiring hate. Hiring the Grand Wizard of the KKK, hiring white supremacists and people from the Aryan Nation to create havoc. So it's seemingly the accusation is to create the havoc so they come in, raise more money, and save the day. You got wire fraud allegations. They misled donors about how the money's going to be used. You got bank fraud allegations, use financial systems to move money under false pretenses, and money laundering using shell companies, hidden channels to disguise where the money would go. So let's think about this. Remember the president of the United States in his first term? We had those riots where sadly somebody lost their lives. And remember, he said there were good people on both sides. And that turns out that was partially financed by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And that was, by the way, ironically, how Joe Biden decided to get in the race when he said that the racist president was making excuses for skinheads. when he was trying to say is that people defending George Washington's statue have a good point, and the people that find it offensive, there were good people on both sides. So what is put in perspective what this Southern Poverty Law Center lawsuit really says to you.
They're grifters. It's that simple. It's a grift. They created a anti-racism industry, and they needed to fuel the hate in order to fight it. It's like an arsonist who sets a fire and then calls the fire department in and says
I'm the hero.
And pretends he's the hero, right? They're the arsonist at that. And the fact that they were funding the Charlottesville march, this was a Potemkin march started by the left. It is absolutely, absolutely stunning, but it doesn't surprise me in the least bit.
Here's the acting U.S. Attorney General Todd Blanche, cut 25.
Why did they want to raise so much money? They needed people to choose to give their hard-earned money to this 501c3 charity, and then they took that money and they diverted a big chunk of it, over $3 million over 2014 to 2023, to the same individuals within the organizations they were against.
Why not?
So, you're talking about as evil as it gets in terms of organizations. You're talking about you actually giving money to the Grand Wizard of the KKK, Aryan Nation, and others. I mean, does this blow you away? And Chuck Schumer's coming out saying that Donald Trump's DOJ is targeting good groups like this one.
Well, you know what? There's going to be a case. This is a grand jury indictment, right? So there's going to be a case, and our judicial system works. And if it's not correct, then that'll come out in the trial. And if it is correct, then Chuck Schumer will have to eat crow.
Well, we'll see if that happens. I want you to hear. What Chuck Schumer said, cut 26.
It doesn't pass the laugh test. It's about Donald Trump turning the Department of Justice into the Department of Vengeance.
So, is he just this is a knee-jerk reaction is going to make him look absolutely terrible? Do you know the investigation started under Joe Biden?
Yeah. I mean, this is what they do. They circle the wagons. Look, Chuck Schumer is on his last legs. This guy is not going to be the leader of the Democratic Party for very much longer. Yes, he's going to eat those words.
So,
without a doubt.
So the Virginia case, it's now a judge has stopped the gerrymander and is being reevaluated right now. Should Florida go back and do the same thing?
Absolutely. I mean, look, first of all, what happened in Virginia, you've got this is as close to a 50-50 state as you have in the country. Like, Kamala Harris won with 51% of the vote or something like that to 52-47. This passed 51-49. It's a split country but they're going to get 90% of the congressional seats. I mean, are you kidding me? But they've been everyone's saying that this is a reaction to Texas. Well, what have you seen before Texas, the map of Illinois, the gerrymandered maps? It's a hard one to have moral high ground on because both sides do it, right? Without a doubt. Both sides, when they have the power, they do it. And so, okay, they did their thing. They've got their power. We fight them in the courts and we try and stop it. But where we have the power to do it, we should do the same thing. And, it's a raw power play, and whoever has the votes and whoever. One of the great things that we have an advantage of is that thanks to Barack Obama, the Republican Party has more unified control of state governments, where they have the governorship, the state legislature, both houses, than Democrats do, because Barack Obama cost the Democrats over 1,000 state legislative seats around the country and a dozen governorships. And so the Republican Party has a massive control of state government. So we should use that power and do it. If they want to do it, we're going to do it. And whoever comes out on top, may the best man win.
And Jeffries came out and said, I'm going to go down and campaign in Florida. We're going to flip those seats regardless of what Florida does. Listen to Ron DeSantis' reaction to that. Cut 44.
I kind of feel bad for the guy because he's as left as they come. He's always going left. And yet the far left hates him. You know, they call him a dollar store Obama. They call him AIPAC Shakur, all these different derogatory names that they do. And so he's tried to ingratiate himself with there, but they're just not drinking the Kool-Aid. And so they give him a hard time. So I kind of feel bad for that.
You think he really feels bad?
I don't think he does. Look, Hakeem Jeffries, I would love, you know, let Hakeem Jeffries cross the Berlin Wall and come into the free state of Florida and see what freedom really looks like. I don't think a lot of people are going to be buying what he's selling there, but he could see what a well-run straight looks like.
All right, let's end the full circle like a Seinfeld episode. Real quick, Mark, what do you expect to happen through this weekend? Do you think we're going to be back at war soon?
I hope so. I hope that look, Donald Trump gave them 2 weeks to come to the table and come up with a deal. When they didn't do it, he gave them a few more days. They've reportedly said 3 to 5 days. So if after 3 to 5 days they don't have a serious counterproposal on the table, I think we start bombing again.
Okay, Mr. Reagan, let's start bombing. Mark Thiessen.
You're getting bombing in 5 minutes, yes. Brian.
Where do we get your podcast, Mark?
It's called What the Hell is Going On, and are you going to come on one of these days? I do your show every friggin' week.
I know. Mark, just ask me.
My show?
Just
what
email me. Hey,
it's
Pete.
It's like a one-way relationship.
Has Mark ever asked you if I could come on his show?
Oh, that's a...
Tell the truth.
I refuse to
Tell
answer.
Tell the truth.
I like both.
All I need is an invitation. That's it.
I'm doing it now in front of millions of people, Brian.
I'm available. Mark Thiessen, thanks so much. But you just can't keep up with me intellectually, and it makes you feel so bad. It hurts your self-esteem.
I know you're on the air like 26 hours a day, so it's kind of hard to get an hour in for my podcast.
Anything,
I understand.
Anything for you, Mark. Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, by the way, don't forget to watch One Nation on Sundays at 10 p.m. And also catch me in Reno May 30th. History, Living, Laughs on stage. Get a chance to be with you. And then July 11th in Pensacola, Florida. Hope to see you there. And in the fall, I have Uniting the States coming out, The Six Crucial Moments That Forged the American Miracle. And I think you're going to love this book. I think it's going to be perfect for 250. Proud of it. And I think also you could see me in person, whether it's in Clearwater, whether it's on Westbury, Long Island, at Westbury Music Fair, over in Red Bank, New Jersey, as well as St. Louis at the Factory. So go to BrianKilmeade.com so I can meet you in person, and I have other big events along all the way. So when we come back, Susan Page joins us. Great new book out. Don't move.
Show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
That money is dried up if I continue down this path the first week of May. Because my payroll to DHS is just over $1.6 billion every 2 weeks. So the money is going extremely fast. And once that happens, there is no emergency funds after that. After we get through April, which I've got 2 more weeks, I've got 1 payroll left, and there is no more emergency funds. So the president can't do another executive order for us to use money because there's no more money there. What Congress needs to do, not Republicans, what the Democrats need to do is explain to the American people why they want open borders and why they don't want to deport these illegals that are truly running our cities and running our streets. And at some point, they need to be held accountable because they're putting homeland at risk.
So that is new Secretary of Homeland Security Mark Ray Mullen, obviously enthused that after a vote-orama, it looks like the House has passed what I think is a skinny reconciliation bill. And the Senate did. Now it's over in the House where they're most likely going to look to add things like further funding for the military. Also, maybe things on the Save America Act. Susan Page knows all about politics. She does it every day. Award-winning Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. Best-selling author with a brand new book out. We'll talk about the Queen and the President's The Hidden Hand That Shaped American History. Susan, welcome back.
Hey, Brian, it's great to be back with you on your great show.
Oh, great. So thank you for saying that. First off, on what's going on, have you ever seen two back-to-back shutdowns, lockouts, unfunding problems that we had in the fall and now we had in the winter that's bleeding into the spring?
This shutdown of DHS, the partial shutdown, sets a record every single day. It's already the longest on record. And I got to say, even though the Senate has managed to patch something together, I don't think there's I think no one in Washington has any confidence that we are see a light at the end of this tunnel.
But it's a partial shutdown. It's not funding all of DHS. It's just ICE and Border Patrol, right?
Yes. And, you know, the fact that it's a partial shutdown and we don't have Social Security checks in danger and the whole government isn't at risk, I think is one reason it keeps the dispute keeps trailing on and on and on, because it doesn't really hit home except for the TSA. And if we begin to see problems again with those incredibly long lines at airports, that is what I think might put pressure on Congress to finally pass something.
So do you believe that any speaker would be able to, period, and through time, through who you've worked with, be able to deal with this slim a majority and get things like this passed?
Well, it's definitely a tough task. I mean, the majority could not be narrower. Now, I will say that Nancy Pelosi did have a very disciplined caucus when she was speaker, sometimes with a narrow majority, but not one as narrow as this. So definitely you got to feel for Mike Johnson every day getting up, trying to hold his people together. And as we're hurtling toward the November midterms, which has, believe me, the focus of every member of Congress.
So that's where we're at right now. And the other big story is the Virginia story. They passed the gerrymandering map that would tilt it blue. A judge steps in and says, hold it. Might be unconstitutional. We're going to wait. How do you see this fight playing out?
Well, we'll see what the Virginia Supreme Court does. But this was a victory for Democrats, for sure. You know, this was a bill that was a measure that was unpopular with independents. And a lot of people like Governor Spanberger and Barack Obama, who had opposed gerrymandering in the past. For Democrats, you know, it was seen as a way to fight back against the efforts Republicans have made in Texas and elsewhere to gerrymander. So I don't know what the Supreme Court in Virginia will decide. But, you know, this is, have you seen the map in Virginia? It looks, it's like all roads lead to Fairfax County. You know, we have five districts taking votes out of Fairfax County, which is mostly Democratic, and just one congressional district there at the bottom of Virginia that still has a Republican majority. That is a feat of mathematics, because Virginia is not a 90% Democratic state. It's been trending Democratic, but they have taken advantage in this map of every single Democratic vote.
Right, and kind of marginalizing the rural community, farmers. They must feel like that they don't have a voice now if this map is approved. What are the chances, from what you know about the Virginia Supreme Court, of them stepping in and certifying the map, the new map?
You know, Brian, of the many things I don't know anything about, I would put the Virginia Supreme Court on that list.
I just always thought you knew everything. So, Susan, tell me about your book. First off, where'd you get the idea about the Queen? I know she has such a long life. I mean, and she's ruled for so long. That'd be one reason why she'd be eligible. When did you realize there was a story there?
She died. She died, and I was reading the obits. This was in 2022. And the obits all said, and she met with 13 sitting American presidents, which seemed like a lot. But they never said what happened. Like, did they just make chit-chat? You know, what happened in sessions with 13 sitting American presidents, more presidents than anyone else from any country has ever met with, by the way, and a record that's unlikely to ever be broken. So the idea for the book was to figure out what happened in those interactions with U.S. presidents. Did she make a difference? And I concluded that she did. And did the presidents have an impact on her? Because I found that that was true also.
So a couple of things. You say that you build the book off of, and what the Queen was about, was what Winston Churchill has said, stay close to the Americans, right?
Yes.
Whatever you think of them, Republican, Democrat, stay close to the Americans. And she actually lived that.
You know, because remember, Winston Churchill understood that the British Empire was in decline. The U.S. role in the world was expanding, was going to take the central role in redefining a new world order after World War II. And for Britain to continue to have a voice, it needed to have a best friend in the United States. And, you know, for decades now, that has been the case under a lot of strain today, that special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. But it was that relationship that Queen Elizabeth took as her mission to protect.
So tell me about some of the relationships. Number one, I know the president really wanted, cared about the queen, cared, still does, as the king gets ready to come here, wanted to win the queen over. Did he, President Trump?
You know, I interviewed President Trump for the book. I'm grateful that he gave me some time. And he said they had the most wonderful conversation at the state dinner she hosted for him in 2019. He said he was in the groove, and he came away from that feeling that they had forged a real connection. And this was important to President Trump because he told me that one of his first childhood memories was sitting next to his mother, who was born in Scotland, on the couch in their home in Queens, New York, watching Elizabeth's coronation.
Okay. What about Reagan and Queen Elizabeth?
You know, I spoke last night at the Reagan Library. I'm actually out here in Simi Valley this morning. And after doing this book, I concluded that Reagan was, in fact, the president who was the closest to a friend of the queen. They had two things in common. They both loved movies. She had seen Reagan as a princess. She had seen Reagan in movies before he ever got into politics. And they both loved horses. And it was a huge bond between them. And I'm sure everybody remembers at least the pictures of the Queen and Reagan riding horses at Windsor Park when he made that first trip as president to England.
And Bill Clinton?
So Bill Clinton had this very complicated relationship with the Queen. You remember their first when Clinton was running for president against George H.W. Bush, the British government looked for dirt on Clinton in their office files to see if, as a Rhodes Scholar, at time of the Vietnam War protests, he had ever done anything that might be embarrassing for him. And when I interviewed President Clinton and also Hillary Clinton for this book, they both recalled that. I mean, it was not the best way to start out a relationship. On the other hand, you know, Bill Clinton did engineer the Good Friday Agreement. And while the Brits were suspicious of this during the process, when it was done, I think they saw it as a positive thing that Bill Clinton had delivered.
And of course, Northern Ireland, you're talking about Northern Ireland. So, Susan, but what kind of role did she play? She built relationships and she was, by almost all accounts, just a great person. Well, what do you think she's accomplished politically on the world stage with our presence?
You know, with our presence, there are a couple of things. You know, her very first trip to Washington as queen was in 1956. And this was right after the Suez Crisis, where relations between the United States and the United Kingdom had been torn apart when Britain defied President Eisenhower and tried to engineer a takeover of the Suez Canal, which, by the way, didn't work. And the Americans officials were no longer like taking the calls from British officials. That's how angry they were. So they sent this young queen over. And of course, she knew Eisenhower from World War II. And she smoothed those waters. And by the time she left, she didn't negotiate Suez. Mm-hmm. She just built a relationship with Eisenhower. She was a reminder of the ties between the two countries that had been so important. And by the time she left, Britons were back on the good side of that administration. And that was only one of several times where she played that kind of role. And you know what, Brian? It reminds me of what King Charles faces next week. It's his first trip to the United States as king, and he faces his own troubles in the relationship over the war in Iran and over the future of NATO.
No question, because there's some rocky relations right now, especially with the prime minister and the president. Susan Page, our guest, and her book is now out, The Queen and Her Presidents, The Hidden Hand That Shaped History. Do you project, in your opinion, from what you know, that King Charles will do something besides shake hands? Will he say, I hope you guys get together? Or would you think he'll try to heal the rift?
So I'm assuming he'll learn lessons from his mother. And that means that when he speaks to the joint meeting of Congress, he's not going to address whether British troops should be deployed at the Strait of Hormuz or exactly what the United States should be doing in NATO. He'll take a bigger view, a longer view, talking about the relationship, the long relationship, the shared values, the shared language between the two countries and why that matters. That's what I would expect to hear. And also in the private meetings with Trump, with President Trump, it's always possible he'll bring up whatever is on his mind. So maybe in their meetings, they will have those kind of substantive discussions, but maybe not. President Trump likes King Charles. I mean, he loved his mother, but he's gotten to feel, I think, warm relations with King Charles as well.
I think he made a choice without asking over Harry. He chose the family over what Harry split off and came here. I think that's pretty clear. And Susan, when you look at your career, how many stories you must have written, how many times you hopped on a Sunday show, and the number one topic was Iran, right? The number one topic is Iran. Hostages, talks, nuclear weapons, proxy, whatever it is, whoever the president is. Where we're at right now is almost unprecedented. First the hit in 2015. We know that that did some damage to their program, obliterated it, but buried it. But now we're trying to get into pickaxe. It's going to be tough to do that new facility that I'm just finding out about in detail. That's going to be might be impenetrable. What do you think is going to be happening here? What do you think is going to be happening next as we're in this tenuous ceasefire and we having trouble finding out who we're negotiating with as Iran is realizing how many of their leaders are dead?
You know, Brian, you're so right. You know, the first presidential campaign I covered was in 80, which was all about the Iranian hostages. It's hugely damaging for President Carter's effort to win another term. And we know from reports that President Trump has mentioned Carter's experience with some concern as he looks at what to do in Iran. It is the question of the day. What comes next? Who negotiates for Iran? Who can deliver? That is not at all clear. And what will Iran take to give the United States an exit ramp, which is clearly what President Trump is looking for? You know, the Iranians have a great advantage over the Americans, which is they do not have to care about their public opinion. They can defy the mood of their public about this war. But President Trump does care about public opinion. And that is something that, you know, the public, we know from every poll that's been taken, the public is opposed to this war, wants it to end.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if it ends the right way with uranium out, observers in to make sure no program kicks in, the strait is open. I would love for the Iranian people to have a say in their government for the first time in my adult life. I watched the way they were tortured, killed in cold blood, charging the parents to go pick up their children and for the bullets used to kill their children. I mean, this is just as horrific as it gets. But if it ends the right way, it could be a huge positive. If it ends the wrong way, it's debatable. Should we have done it? My sense is that I think there's going to be another chapter to the military confrontation. What about you?
I think we are not nearly at the end of the Iran story, and that whatever happens this day, this week, that you and I will be talking about Iran until our last day on the air.
And we used to think it was Iraq, right? It used to be Iraq, and now it's Iran. And of course, it's very interesting to not talk about Israel as the problem. Because even the Gulf states are not doing that. The one thing I would say, Susan, is this the first time, too, that you look in the Arab world and see they care more about their economy than it seems to be their theocracy? And they seem more in our corner. And they definitely see Iran as we see them, as the problem in the Middle East.
Yeah. You know, and I think that may have always been true, but they were unwilling to say so. But yes, I think we've seen such a shift in the region. In some ways, a positive one, as the one you're mentioning. I think we're in a pivot point in the world. We've had this infrastructure, this global infrastructure that was forged after World War II, and that's, you know, things don't stay the same.
Yep.
And I think we are in the midst of a kind of reconfiguration of global power centers and of traditional alliances. And Iran is part of that.
Yeah, in fact, you're in AI and everything's changed. Susan Page, thanks so much. One consistent has always been the queen. You write about it. The queen and her presidents, the hidden hand that shaped history. Susan, thanks so much. Congratulations.
Hey, Brian, thank you.
Back in a moment.
He just doesn't read the headlines. He breaks them down. Real talk, real news. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Absolutely. Florida has the right and the intention to do it, and my view is that they should. Democrats started this. The Republican states are doing what they can do lawfully under their state laws, and in a state like California, Virginia, they had to defy their own constitutions to play a dishonest game. The people are taking account of this. They're voting accordingly, and we are on track to win in November. Watch.
And we'll see. And that, of course, is Speaker Johnson talking about the gerrymandering that took place and passed barely, even though, you know, you got a governor that won, the Democratic governor won that race by about 10 points. This one by about 1.5. And they get gerrymandered. It's going to be more of a Democratic state if, in fact, it goes. It's, you pick up about 4 seats. But now a judge looked at it and says unconstitutional. So it's going to the Virginia Supreme Court. If they say it's unconstitutional, if you go to the Supreme Court, I'm pretty sure they're not going to instate it. So I think that Florida is going to be on the clock to do the same thing there. And of course, Speaker Johnson said, go ahead and do it. Governor DeSantis has a way of taking on these challenges and embracing it. He's already done that. You're listening to Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. 40th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. We're coming your way. Well, I guess a few miles away, we'll have the NFL draft. It's going to be big news. It's become a big event. Jimbo Covert, he's a Pro Football Hall of Famer with the Bears. He's going to be offering his analysis. And Pittsburgh, they say, could have 500,000 people. Number one, it's successful from so many different areas. Number two, it's just a huge football city. It's got this great awareness. They got Mike McCarthy. They're pumped up to change things. They do need a quarterback. We'll talk about that. Doug Schoen is standing by, former Clinton advisor, former Bloomberg advisor, Democratic strategist and pollster. I want to talk about where we go from here in the midterms. How you think the Venezuelan operation, Iranian operation, perhaps the flip of Cuba from communist to capitalist, how that will all play at all in the midterms. Doug Schoen on that, as well as Democrats. I thought about him right away when I saw Barack Obama show up to be with Mayor Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, over on Saturday. Why is he picking that candidate as the future of his party? Big three.
Number three.
That money is dried up if I continue down this path the first week of May. What the Democrats need to do is explain to the American people why they want open borders. They need to be held accountable because they're putting homeland at risk.
That is the new Secretary of Homeland Security, hoping to get fully funded. The Senate gave him a skinny bill. I think the House is going to work on that bill to the point where they got to send it back to the Senate. Will they ever agree on a way forward, because the Democrats in the minority don't want to fund ICE, don't want to fund Border Patrol, and in the caught in the crossfire, the TSA.
Number two. You will see that these banking institutions tie directly the funding mechanisms in which the Southern Poverty Law Center used to fund at least 8 hate groups they supposedly wanted to take out, but they were paying the very villains of our society they supposedly wanted to protect us from.
The Southern Poverty Law Center, putting lives in danger as they pay off the vile groups they were created to fight against. I know it's hard to wrap your head around. I'll explain.
Number one.
They still fear there's Mossad agents everywhere. They're not sure who's in charge. No one knows whose orders to take and accept. So to negotiate at the highest levels with the United States of America has proven very complicated for them. And that makes it hard for our side, too.
Blockade in place as Iran's Mosquito Navy gets aggressive. The standoff with Iran continues. And let's bring in Doug Schoen. Doug, first off, when you talk about Iran, with all your years of experience, they have been a problem for every president, right?
They have been a problem. And I must tell you,
Fortunately, now we have a president who is dealing with Iran. And I must say, while we don't have a peace agreement yet, we have a ceasefire that is very shaky, I know. He has done more to degrade and destabilize their administration than anyone in my memory. I give him thanks for that. But I would say, having watched and observed, as you have, Brian, the only thing the Iranians understand is power. It's not more negotiating, it's more power. So to my way of thinking, it needs to be a carrot and stick approach. Trump has put the emphasis on the carrot. I put the emphasis on the stick.
So you think we might have to go back again? Dasha Burns on the problem with the talks. Cut seven. She's with she was on Special Report last night with Politico. Cut seven.
And on the blockade piece of this, clearly Iran views that as a continued threat and continued escalation. And blockades take time. Yes, it's significant pressure, but it's pressure over time that is the most impactful. And right now, time works to Iran's advantage here. According to folks close to the White House that I've been talking to, the president ultimately called Iran's bluff, felt like they weren't going to be able to come and deliver something when they with these potential talks in Islamabad, and so pulled the plug on the whole thing. The concern is that it's not clear how unified the Iranian government is, or if they can get to a unified position to actually deliver on a deal. And what I'm hearing from foreign policy experts is that it's part of the problem of eliminating so much of the leadership structure in Iran, where it is fragmented at this point, and it's hard to figure out how to get that deal delivered.
So in your estimation, Doug, how much is just they're so fractured and can't get on the same page, and how much is it that surviving is winning for them?
I think it's more the latter than the former. I think if they see that their survival is at risk, they will reach a consensus more quickly. I have no doubt, Brian, that there are divisions between the new supreme leader, the Revolutionary Guard, and the various factions. But the way I see it, when in doubt, you have to make it clear to them that there will be pain for their society, their culture, and what's left of their military, unless and until they come to the table in good faith.
And Doug, it looks like we have about another week to 10 days for the admiral in charge to Cooper to hit everything that he wanted to do ahead of time. And it's your judgment, which I'm hearing in your voice and what you've said so far, is we got to go back to that and finish them off.
I think that's right. I mean, Brian, we've spent years talking about these issues. Do you really believe that it's an issue of we're not negotiating well, or we don't have a clear statement of principle? I think we do.
We do.
I think we have good negotiators and a clear position. They don't want to do a deal because time is on their side in their estimation. It may be wrongheaded, but that's how they're thinking.
So you have Chris Murphy, you have Chuck Schumer, almost every Democrat not named John Fetterman against this operation. Bad war, Seth Moulton, a Marine, we've already lost. Really doing damage to us on the world stage. Governor Walz going over to Barcelona saying the president lost his mind and did a war of choice. Have you ever seen, you've seen a lot of partisan politics. This is the worst of the worst when it comes to Trump.
My problem, and I say this as somebody who still is a Democrat, who disagrees with much of what Trump has done, how can I, as an American who wants to avoid a nuclear conflagration, who wants to avoid state-sponsored terrorism, and wants to protect the state of Israel and the Jewish people, how can I object to policies that I think are certainly directed to achieving those goals? We can disagree about tactics. We can disagree about substance in many areas. But how can we not applaud this administration and this president for what he has set out to do?
I want to talk a little bit of politics. And another one of your contemporaries, James Carville, was in the news again. And James Carville says, Democrats get power back? This is what they should do. Cut 51.
The Democrats win the presidency in both houses of Congress. I think on day one, they should make Puerto Rico, D.C. a state, and they should expand the Supreme Court to 13. eat our dust. The only way to fight this is don't run on it, don't talk about it, just do it. She said, okay, we got 54 senators and we got 13 mm-hmm. court members. Thank you, goodbye. Because you're not going to get a fair shake any kind of way in this system. 18% of the United States elects 52 senators. Well, you're not going to make it equitable, but you'll make it better by adding Puerto Rico and D.C.
Your thoughts on that? That, to me, is a campaign ad for Republicans.
It is more than that. It is a campaign ad for our enemies, suggesting that our democratic values and our Constitution are supposed to be fungible and malleable to achieve a narrow partisan goal. What's to stop the Republicans from doing something similar when and if they get back into power? I must tell you, Brian, I did not like the opening of the redistricting wars in different states. I don't like the way either party's approached it. But if we go down the rat hole that James Carville is recommending, our democracy, our values, and what we believe and stand for as a country will be gone. We tried court packing once with FDR. It was one of his worst and arguably most disastrous decisions. I don't think we need to go back to that and start adding states simply to achieve a narrow, short-sighted political goal.
So what are your thoughts about this Senate candidate in Michigan who's embracing Hassan Piker, who is afraid to say negative things about the Grand Ayatollah of Iran? What is your take on the woman that just won the 11th district over in New Jersey, an extremist even for the squad, and the mayor in New York City, who was so bright and bubbly, President Obama thought he'd spend his weekend with him? What do you make of some of these emerging personalities in your party?
Well, very sadly, my party is now 70 to 80% anti-Israel. And the extremists that you're pointing to have a hostility to Israel. I think in Michigan, El Sayed, if I'm correct, I may have it wrong,
yep, El Sayed,
but I think I'm
yep.
right, has equated Israel to Hamas. Basically, Israel's a terrorist state, and Hamas is obviously a terrorist group. Hannah Piker has said horrific and horrible things. The two of them are campaigning together. And again, Mamdani is completely hostile to, in terms of foreign policy, notwithstanding his congeniality and affability, everything that I believe is most important in our world. So I am beyond distraught by what I see, and it makes it very, very difficult for me to stay a Democrat, especially in light of the drift of my party.
You know, it's so interesting because President Obama could go anywhere. I mean, I don't really know a lot about Governor Beshear, but to be a popular governor in a red state is something. You have Governor Shapiro.
Yeah.
Governor Shapiro, who looked up to President Obama, has the same cadence. Mm-hmm. He's almost mimicked him. You could go there. And then you could even say Wes Moore, even though he's got a huge problem with his biography, what he says and what he does. You see, there's other places for him to go. Why he went to New York City to a guy that says there should be no billionaires? By the way, I think he's a billionaire, Barack Obama. And that, you know, we have to, landlords are the issue and free buses and free, all these things that you know are going to fall spectacularly. What does he see in that guy that he thinks is the future of his party, his way of claiming back his legacy, which Trump has steamrolled?
The only thing I can say, Brian, the first foreign trip that Obama took was to the Middle East, and he didn't go to Israel. He went to Egypt. He gave a speech that, again,
apology.
Did not support the values that certainly I know you hold, and I'd like to believe I try to articulate every day. I can't understand why Obama would do it. It's not like he was endorsing a candidate. To read stories to children sends a message that he is not on our side on these critical fights.
So Venezuela, you wrote a book about it, about Chavez and followed by Maduro. And then you have this president go in a brilliant military operation. He's now in a Brooklyn prison. And you have Delcy Rodriguez running the country for now until they get a vote. And I'm sure she'll be voted out. But little by little, getting rid of all the henchmen of Maduro while letting out political prisoners. And there hasn't been massive unrest. And there has been oil production by American companies. Your thought on where we're at with Venezuela now?
Look, we're heading in the right direction. As a supporter of Maria Corina Machado, I want early elections. I think the idea of waiting 2 years for an election is a mistake. But I think the will of the Venezuelan people should be reflected in who their leaders are. I think if we stand for democracy, as I believe we do and should, we should push for that election and let the chips fall where they may. I mean, Maria Corina's made it clear she supports the Trump administration. She gave him her Nobel Prize, saying that he deserved it. And let's have an election and decide how Venezuela should be governed, not from Washington, but from Caracas and the rest of the country.
Right. But it is a major change in the positive, and it's allowed maybe Cuba to flip to capitalists, right?
Well, that would be great if Cuba did shift. And I can only commend the president and urge that he make continued efforts to continue that fight. I'm living now, Brian, in South Florida, in Miami, in Bal Harbour. I talk to Cuban Americans all the time. It is literally their dream to be able to go back to a free and democratic Cuba. And they want their families out of slavery. And I use that word literally and metaphorically.
And by the way, Monday, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is working. They're meeting and trying to land that plane peacefully and make that transition, because a massive blockade is on right now. Only one ship got through, and we let a Russian oil ship get through to provide some temporary aid. Doug Schoen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. Always a pleasure.
All right, same here. 1-866-408-7669. Bottom of the hour, we have a little bit of fun. Talk about the NFL draft. Giants got two picks. Jets got one, number three overall. We'll see what they're going to do with it. Also around the country, you got Jacksonville Jaguars looking to build on their fantastic season. And, of course, Ohio is filled with fantastic teams. And Pittsburgh is going to be the place of 500,000 people are going to pour in to surround Three River Stadium. And talk about things that matter most to Pittsburgh, and that is football. Don't move.
In a world of noise, get the signal. Sharp, informative, and always on point. You're listening to Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think all taxes should be progressive. The very wealthy, the billionaires, should pay more. The problem with a gas tax or a vehicle's mild travel tax is that it does the opposite. It punishes the lowest income Californians, those who have the longest commutes to work and can least afford fancy vehicles.
Yeah, but you still have it there, and it's been there forever. And that's Katie Porter trying to rehabilitate her image and take advantage of the collapse of Swalwell, who was the front runner by just a couple of points in the big race for the governor's spot in California. Right now, it's two Republicans, first and second, and they're going to have a primary, and then they're going to have actually have the election in November. Steve Hilton is number one. Last night was a big debate. They interacted a little bit of an exchange. Here's a little bit from Steve Hilton. 6 seconds, cut 30.
The first point is that to open up California oil production doesn't need the legislature because it's through executive action.
Right, that's a little short. How about Matt Mahan? He is the so-called moderate mayor from San Jose, Democrat. Cut 33.
We've created the first AI upskilling curriculum for our workforce so that they aren't displaced by technology, but they can use it to enhance their work. I am not afraid to regulate big tech or any other industry. And as governor, I'll make sure we protect the people of California.
It's not like he got it right. I think his time was just up. And the guy that now people say is the front runner is Xavier Becerra. He's terrible. Cut 34.
Mr. Becerra, you were chair of the Democratic caucus when Eric Swalwell was elected to Congress. You said in a recent interview that, quote, many of us heard the rumors. What rumors did you hear? And should you have pursued the rumors as a member of Democratic leadership? You have 60 seconds.
Thanks, Nikki. Yeah, you hear rumors all the time about all sorts of things. Rumors are not facts, and the Democratic caucus is not a place that adjudicates those things. It's law enforcement that does. If someone had come forward, we could then have investigations. Unfortunately, we have a president today who would go after someone based on rumors. That's not the way we do it in America. We have to have the facts. Rumors are one thing, but getting the facts really gets you to move.
Isn't it amazing they have to bring up Trump in some way, shape, or form on every answers? Well, rumors are also leads. I don't know if I should back this guy because I'm hearing some things. You could go find out the answer to your worry.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The Bears with their first of two picks. Don Weiss has the card. He'll go up to the commissioner and get the first pick of two. The second would be from Tampa Bay later in this first round. Here's the commissioner.
Chicago Bears. Bears pick on the first round. Jimbo Colbert tackles Pittsburgh.
Okay, two tackles, two big tackles have gone so far in this first round, hitting from Northwestern. Jimbo Colbert, one of the strongest offensive tackles ever to play the college game from the University of Pittsburgh, now goes to the Chicago Bears.
Wow. Why would I bring up the 1983 draft with Jimbo Colbert? Because Jimbo Colbert turned out to be a Hall of Famer. And, of course, drafted in 83, that team came into its own in 85, 86, 84, 85, I should say. And he was a main part of that. Jimbo, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, Brian. Great to be here. Thank you.
Hey, set the scene. Was it a little different back then? That was New York City, right, when you were drafted? Yeah. You knew you were going to be a first rounder, right? Were you there?
Right. No, I wasn't there. No one went back then. You know, I think it was the second year the draft was on television. I tell the story all the time that, you know, we didn't have cable television. It was on ESPN. We didn't have cable. So my brother invited some guys over from the mill. We took the day off. I invited some people. We had downstairs. We had some beer and refreshments. And we only had one phone, so no cell phones or anything. And so the phone was always busy. My brother calling. Finally, I get a call, and it's Jim Finks, the general manager. He said, "What the heck's going on over there? We drafted you in the sixth pick. They were already in the ninth pick. I didn't even know I got drafted." So that's how different it is. Yeah, that's how different it is. They flew me to Chicago. I spent a day with them. But, yeah, when you only have one phone, no social media, no cell phones, no text, no anything, right? It was just a landline phone, and it was always busy. So, yeah, that's the difference now.
Did you realize it was something special when you walked in there? Did you see the talent yet? Or was it just coming up in 83?
Well, when I got drafted there, the only one I really recognized was, you know, the name was Walter Payton, right? And then, you know, Mike Dick is from Aliquippa, right across from where I grew up in Conway. So he's always a legend. So I knew that. But, you know, we weren't very good in 83, but we started to turn it around, and we won our last, I think, seven out of eight, and we finished 8-8. And that kind of set the stage for the next year. We went to the NFC Championship game. But I think in 83, I think 8 or 9 of us rookies made the team. So that was a big deal, the 83 draft.
Right. And then, of course, the team, hit their stride. And the team is still talked about today as one of the greatest teams ever. What role did Mike Ditka have the right team at the right time? Do you think he would have won in his prime with anyone?
Yeah, but I think you're exactly right. I think he was the right coach at the right time for that team, right? It needed discipline. It needed a different approach. There was a lot of guys just kind of hanging out, you know, cashing a paycheck. And I remember one of my first practices, he came in, he said, "I got good news and bad news. As good news, we're going to the Super Bowl. Bad news is half you guys won't be here when we do." And he meant that. And he was right about that. And 3 years later, half that team was turned over. So we had some work to do. You know, guys weren't willing to pay the price, but he was the right guy for the job.
Absolutely. So, Jim, as we look at this draft, it's much different now. They expect about 500,000 people in Pittsburgh.
It's crazy. I'm here right now. It's you know, I'm in Pittsburgh right now. It's my hometown.
This is a football city. I mean, they're not rallying to a big event. This is what they do.
Yeah. I mean, just on the off season, you see people walking around downtown with Steeler jerseys on, right? I mean, so this is a football town. It always has been football area. I grew up in Beaver County. We had a bunch of Hall of Famers there. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So I get to do the second round pick, and, you know, hopefully they don't trade it. I get up there and say it's traded. So at least maybe I get a chance to make a pick. We'll see.
But don't you think Bears are back? Got a fantastic quarterback, really good coach. I feel like you guys, the Bears are hitting their stride.
Yeah, well, we got a quarterback, which we've always needed for a while. And, But I also think they built that offensive line. I think the year before he gave up like 60-some sacks, which is just outrageous. And then the next year they built that offensive line up, and I think they cut that in, you know, more than half. So, you know, you need that pass protection, and they got some targets to throw to. But he's a special player, and I think he's going to take us to some good wins in the next couple of years.
Jimbo Covert, our guest, spent 8 years with the Bears, ends up in the Hall of Fame with some of the fantastic teams in sports. There's no mystery about Fernando Mendoza. He'll be the number one pick overall. But, man, would it take three schools for him to find his stride? I mean, Joe Burrow's, too, was unknown until his last year. What about the things that bring a player to this moment? We never used to have that. Maybe one transfer you'd hear.
Right.
How do you feel about
it? You had to sit out a year. Yeah, you had to sit out a year. Remember, Brian?
Yeah.
And now there's unlimited transfers. So a lot of guys might not have a fit and get a chance to play, and they transfer somewhere else, and some good things happen. Exactly what you've been saying about Mendoza. So, and Joe Burrow and other people as well. So I'm not a big fan of the unlimited transfer rule. I think college sports with
the
NIL there. Yeah. And that NIL and transfer portal in the same universe is difficult to exist for a long period of time. I don't think it's sustainable. So if you could just go back to the one-time transfer rule, that takes a lot of NIL pressure off as well, because a guy transfers once and then he gets paid and he can't go anywhere else. So I'd like to see that. But, you know, it worked for guys like Mendoza, but I want to see him get a degree too. They're student athletes. So I would like to see him get a degree and stay in college and get a degree.
Carson Beck of Miami had that line when asked, week leading up to the game, he's waiting for the championship game. They go, "Do you find it hard to study?" He said, "Study? I'm not in school. I graduated." And he was taking one course, and he's 25 years old, taking one course. Yeah. And then everyone was shocked, not you, because you know the new landscape in college football, but the average fan was going, "What? You're not even, you don't have bad grades, you have no grades."
Yeah. Well, I think at Pitt, the 1 year we beat West Virginia a couple of years ago, I think that quarterback was that was his fifth school. You know, you had the COVID year, you had all this other stuff that kind of, you know, gave guys extra years of eligibility. So I'm just not a big fan of that. And I just think that, you know, it's not a sustainable system.
So let's talk about the draft a little. So, I mean, some of the players that are going to go early, people have number two, the Jets, after Mendoza goes to the Raiders, and I think he'll be great. The Jets possibly will get David Bailey at Texas Tech. They traded away their best edge rusher. The Arizona, you know, they need a lot. They might be going for an edge rusher too. Arvell Reese, your thoughts about where Tennessee or the Giants might go? We'll have two picks in the top 10. A lot of people think the Giants going to get Jordan Tyson, wide receiver.
Yeah. You know, I just think a lot of times circumstances change when they get there. They're targeting a certain player that they want. If they want to maybe get a defensive player, an edge rusher, edge rushers are always valued. They're hard to come by. Or even some of those inside tackles are hard to come by. And then someone gets picked and they have to change their strategy. You know, and I think that's what happens a lot of times. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know where these guys are going to go. You know, I think you see when the draft comes out, when guys get picked and they get slotted, then we'll see what other teams are looking for. I know the Bears are thinking probably more defense because they got some good offensive linemen. They got some good receivers. I think they're going to go there. You know, I think the Giants might go defense as well. So it's going to be difficult. I kind of pay more attention, Brian, to the NFC than I'm an NFC guy, you know, and I think I'd pay a little bit more attention to that, especially the NFC North where the Bears are.
I mean, they say next year's draft is going to be full of high-profile names from Arch Manning on down, that this year you got to do some a little bit more hunting. Is there anybody in particular that you think that has stood out for you, Jimbo?
I like the running back from Notre Dame. I think he's done a really good job, and I think we played them, and he tore us up Pitt pretty good.
Jeremiah Love?
He's a really good player. But, you know, running backs have been a little bit undervalued. You know, and I think that you've seen that the last couple of years. When I played, running backs were really highly valued, and they were first round guys, top 10 picks. And then it got to more of a passing offense in the NFL, and they started to get a little undervalued. And you remember what happened with Saquon, right? There was the same thing that happened with him. They kind of undervalued him, and look, he went and they won a Super Bowl. And so I don't know. I mean, I think running backs are still pretty valuable. I'd like to see. I think he's going to go a top five pick, in my opinion.
So I'm good friends with Tim Greene. You know, he had a fantastic player at college and pros, played 7-8 years. Now he's dealing with ALS, and he's still doing a podcast, and they found a way to recreate his voice. You watch ALS ravage a great teammate of yours and friend of yours, Steve McMichael, and you want to raise awareness about ALS because for some reason, despite all the attention, we're still dealing with Lou Gehrig's disease and it's nothing but mystery.
Oh, yeah, exactly right. So I've been involved with the Robert Packard Center for ALS Research in Johns Hopkins about 8 years ago. Now, even before my teammate Steve was diagnosed with ALS, and I just, for me, they recruited me there, but for me, it seemed to me like it was some real connection between, you know, football players, concussions in the military, and neurological diseases like ALS and Parkinson's. And I just saw a connection there. So I went there and helped them. They've done some fantastic research. And now we're continuing to raise money for that. And we're doing this coast-to-coast ALS race, bike race, 4,000 miles. It's going to raise money and awareness for ALS. But you're right, Brian. You got Tim Green. You got Steve Gleason. You got Dwight Clark. I mean, Kevin Turner. You got there's a number of guys that have had this, and we want to continue to try to raise awareness for
it. So do you think there's a link, Jimbo, when you sit down with on these board of directors and talk to these experts?
I think there is, but I mean, I think it's anecdotal, you know? I mean, there's not really a lot of science behind it, but they're trying to be, and I think that you're seeing that, in my opinion, trauma, brain trauma, I think has a connection to neurological diseases that you can develop later on in your life.
I mean, just think about, too, for you, when you were playing, if you got your bell rung, hey, you okay? Get your helmet on, get back out there. And I think we're all, everybody, from the fans to the refs to the players to the coaches, know that's a huge problem. And if you're not paying attention, there's a protocol in place. I mean, are these necessary things?
Absolutely. I mean, I wish they had concussion protocol when I played. They never had anything like that. Your concussion protocol was how many fingers I have up. It was always two, right? So that was it. And I've seen guys get knocked out, fall down, go out of the game. And if his backup fumbles or something happens, they try to get the guy back in the game. I've seen it a million times. And so those are what happens. I think when you get your bell rung like that, it's not really that. It's a concussion. And then you go back in and you get a one right after that. That's when the train starts going downhill.
I
think concussion protocols are important.
And if people want to support ALS and the mission that you're on, they go to?
Yeah, Coast to Coast for ALS.
Got it.
And so you'll see it there. So it's going to be a great run for us. And we're hoping to try to get me on a bike in Chicago. I haven't been on a bike in 40 years. So we'll see. They say you never forget how, but we'll see.
You got the build. You can handle it. So Jimbo, do you remember this interview by Mean Gene in WrestleMania 2, Cut 55?
Right now, let's welcome Super Bowl champion Chicago Bear Jimbo Covert. Battle Royal in Chicago is part of the gigantic event of a lifetime, WrestleMania 2. You've got a wrestling background as an amateur.
Yes, I do, Mean Gene, and I'm looking forward to this Battle Royale. Me and Refrigerator Perry are going to gang up on some of these Dallas Cowboys and some of these so-called wrestlers and give it to them.
All right, Jimbo, thank you very much. Congratulations, by the way, on that big one down in New Orleans, Super Bowl champions.
So there you go, and that Super Bowl coach being the Patriots. Was that fun?
That was a lot of fun. I always tell people, they talk about Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders. I'm a two-sport professional athlete as well.
Absolutely.
I did WrestleMania. But no, that was a lot of fun. They asked me to do it, and the Bears weren't too happy about it. They thought I was going to get hurt. And when they realized that it was, essentially a show, they let me do it. So it was a lot of fun.
So I want you to hear, remember this moment too, when you guys crushed the Patriots. I believe that was with Steve Grogan as quarterback, or was it Tony Eason?
Tony Eason to start, and then Steve Grogan.
Here it is.
So that's how it worked, yeah.
46-10, Cunt 54.
Probably the last play of the game. We're getting ready to carry Dick. Dicka doesn't want to go yet. He says, wait till I see that final second. Who's going to argue with Perry? He wins most of those. Walter Payton, Mike Ditka, hungry Chicago, finally champions on this January day in New Orleans. 46-10, the final.
I believe that was Dick Enberg. Have you watched that game back?
Oh, yeah, several times. And that was Dick Enberg and Merlin Olsen did the game. So it was a lot of fun. And I think Bob Costas did the pregame. It was a spectacle. It was kind of cool. And we went there to win a football game. I think the Patriots got there, are happy to be there, And I think, they had to, They kind of recovered fumbles on their way there. They beat Miami down there in the rain, and we want to play Miami again, you know, because they beat us during the regular season.
Only team.
And, only team. Best thing that ever happened was, Brian, because I think it refocused us and said, hey, this isn't going to be easy. We're going to have to work hard, and we ran the table after that. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I also remember you beating the Giants. Was it 14-6?
No, I think we shot them out 21-0.
21-0? Was it a championship game in 85?
No, it was a playoff game. First playoff game in 85. And then we played the Rams. We shut them out, too. And then we went to the Super Bowl. We'd have shut them out, too, if we didn't have a fumble early on with kind of a bad formation that McMahon called. And he called the wrong formation. They ran into each other. Walter fumbled and... Yeah, we probably would have shut them out, too.
Well, Jimbo Covert, besides that, you don't remember much about it. Congratulations on everything. I love the fact that you're fighting for ALS, and enjoy Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it. Yep. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. And by the way, the whole NFL draft, the world's going to be watching. And even if you're not the biggest football fan, it is fun. But it's a fun thing to watch. So day one. Day two is a little much. Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Democrats do not play politics the way Republicans do. The difference between the parties, Joy. They do not.
Please.
Democrats play by the Marquise de Queensberry rules. I think they do not. They're not rule breakers. They couldn't even hold out on a government shutdown because eight of them turned tail and gave in. Democrats capitulate and they try to play by the rules. Republicans don't care about the rules. They rewrite the rules.
Stupidest thing you've ever heard, and Joy Reid put the bar very high for stupid things. And talking to Maury Povich, yes, he's still alive, Joy Reid comes out and says, Democrats don't know how to play these games. They play by the Marquis of Queensberry's rules, which is the famous rules for boxing. What about the Russia investigation? The whole hoax that went on it, the ridiculous impeachment mess. What about the whole Hunter Biden cover-up where the FBI was basically told, don't even think about investigating Hunter Biden and his son? Look about what they're doing right now with the lockdown, the shutdown in the fall, and still carried from the winter to the spring on DHS. All they do is disrupt. That's all they do. I mean, do you see them getting on board with anything? You see them, what they're doing, going to Barcelona, ripping the president? They looking to get along? They play by the Marquis of Queensberry rules? I wonder what those rules are. That's absolutely insane. So, I mean, I don't know who listens to a podcast. In a way, I don't want people listening to people like that. I think that's so good that she doesn't have a job anymore. It's so good that Don Lemon doesn't have a job anymore that matters. And by the way, I've talked to people that looked at that case. He's in trouble. They have a lot of video, and he posted a lot of it, a lot of incriminating. Just a quick note, go to BrianKilmeade.com. I'm going to be doing History, Liberty, and Laughs and transferring to the Uniting the States tour. I'm going to be at Bartley Ranch at Hawkins Amphitheater in Reno, Nevada on the 30th. July 11th in Pensacola at the Pensacola Sanger Theater. October 16th, Red Bank, New Jersey. The next day, October 17th in Westbury, Uniting the States Tour. In Clearwater, Florida, November 7th. And the next day in Jacksonville. And then we're going to be in St. Louis, November 21st with the Uniting the States book. The Six Moments That Forged the American Miracle. I think you're going to love it. And I know if you love the country, you'll love it. And don't forget One Nation, Sunday at 10 p.m. See you tomorrow on Fox and Friends. And keep it here on the Brian Kilmeade Show.